Welcome to TWT FM, a weekly podcast from the world transformed, bringing year-round radical political education and utopian thinking to bear on the issues that define our world. In our second series, we're exploring the concept of leisure, and in particular, aspects of life we've been missing due to the COVID crisis. What does leisure time reveal about our relationship to work and time under capitalism, and how our lives might be different with access to more of it? Join us as we delve into our favourite leisure activities, including football, holidays and more, with the wide-angle lens you'd expect from TWT. As ever, please subscribe and share the podcast with friends if you haven't already. For now though, turn up your headphones, sit back and listen up. This is The World Transformed.
Welcome to TWTFM, a podcast from The World Transformed. In this series, we're exploring COVID and the crisis of leisure, and today, we're going deep on dance. Many of the members of the TWTFM team have really missed dancing during this past year of lockdowns. But with their enclosed spaces, sweaty bodies, and often licentious activities, it seems as if dance floors might just be the last places to reopen after COVID. So we hope that this episode will serve as a suitable replacement to satisfy our yearning, an ode to moving our bodies together. Throughout the episode, we have items on sound systems, anti-fascist dancers, and activists fighting closures of the clubs and DIY spaces across the country. There will be a meditation on David Mancuso's vision of the perfect house party, and we will explore how issues of space, time, and resistance to commodification are borne out through dance. Dance with music, dance without music, dance on dance floors, the stage, and dance in the streets. So stay tuned.
But before we begin, we wanted to start with an anecdote taken from Barbara Ehrenreich's Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy. It's a brilliant book that tracks the history of dance from an essential cultural practice in the West to a marginalised one. It's jam-packed with loads of interesting and eye-opening stories and a real page-turner. We recommend you pick it up if you haven't already. But this one story stuck with us from the book that we wanted to share. Today, there can be found a deep groove set in the pavements and yards outside some French and Italian medieval churches. Kind of like a snaking labyrinth or, as some scholars suggest, a guide for a medieval conga line. Led by the priest, congregations would wind their way around the sacred grounds of the church, dancing in union, propelled by the Holy Spirit. This evidence reflects the popular theory that 12th century Christianity was a danced religion. Church services often involved dancing, singing, and drinking as part of the service, with the clergy whipping up a frenzy. There's even mention of hallucinogens in Ehrenreich's book. Papal authorities caught wind of the fun that was happening within the church walls and began to crack down on the dancing. Their first step was to encourage congregants to take their dancing away from the church grounds, and then to isolate festivities to feast days only. In 1215, the requirement of annual confession began, and one popular confession that churchgoers would repent for was, and I quote, "lascivious dancing in or near a church." To compensate for the dulling of the service, they introduced a new set of gimmicks, like incense, ornately decorated interiors, and more ritualised practice around relics. But the damage had been done, the marginalisation of dance had begun. The congregation, having been driven from the churchyards, took the ecstatic practices of communal dancing, singing, and costuming themselves to new sites in their villages and communities. They used many Catholic feast days, when work was banned, to party. These were the origins of the carnival that we still enjoy today. So why did the papal authorities do this? Dancing then was feared for its irrationality, its wildness. It was seen as savage and a threat to the natural order of society. The powerful feared the ecstatic state of the dancers and wanted a monopoly on access to the divine. They feared that ecstatic dance would allow people to sidestep the mediation of the church and tap into the divine spirit themselves, that people would become autonomous and the church irrelevant. In Dancing in the Streets, Ehrenreich quotes historian E.P. Thompson's descriptions of the medieval carnival. He writes, Many weeks of heavy labour and scanty diet were compensated for by the expectation of these occasions, when food and drink were abundant, courtship and every kind of social intercourse flourished, and the hardship of life was forgotten. These occasions were, in an important sense, what men and women lived for. And so, from this story, we see repression of dance for its communality, its irrationality, its danger to the existing orders of power. It is this dynamic that repeats itself across European history and plays out through the rest of Ehrenreich's book. But from this particular story, we also see a difficult tension between work and leisure, and the compartmentalisation of joy. The result of the church distancing itself from these sort of activities was a certain secularisation of communal pleasure. But, as Ehrenreich writes, while this secularisation might have drained festivities of their ecstasy, they had a secondary, unintended benefit. They also gave people ownership of and control over them. Here, she quotes the German poet Goethe, that carnival is a festival that is not given to the people, but one the people give themselves. It's this exact journey for ownership and control over dancing, both where we dance and how we dance, that we'll be exploring in this episode.
Are you, absolutely. Do you have anything to say about the offence?
Raves aren't anti-lockdown, they're anti-capitalism.
And, you know, the threat of spreading the virus,
beer is a
guarantee
of control. People are affected by the modern way of life, whether there's raves on or not.
This audio comes from a video widely shared online recently of a teenage Bristolian coming out of a magistrate's court, apparently having been prosecuted for attending a lockdown rave. It inspired a bit of a spat on Twitter, obviously, which in the end boiled down to the question, what's more radical, dancing or striking? Of course TWT doesn't endorse plague raves, but it got us thinking, why can't we have both? Why can't we dance and strike at the same time? Members of the United Voices of the World Union, who work as care staff at the Sage Nursing Home in London, have been out on strike this year, attracting our attention with their vibrant, joyous and dancey picket lines. We spoke to two strikers to find out what they're dancing for and why.
Yeah, my name is Billy, a senior healthcare assistant at the Sage Nursing Home and a member of the UBW, United Voice of the World.
My name's Isabel. I am organising with the Sage workers for UBW and I'm also the women's officer at UBW.
The strike has been about our demand. We decided that quality care deserves quality pay. And for a long time, we've been underpaid, undervalued, overlooked for too long. So we make a stand at Sage Nursing Home and for all other workers that risk their life under the pandemic and before the pandemic been working. So we are looking after the elderly in the community, in society. So we think that we deserve better pay and better quality living wage, sick pay in parity with the NHS. Therefore, we all regroup and join the UBW, which help us and support us in these disputes.
So say the Sage dispute was sparked by a member, a care worker called Bella, back in March. She was involved in the women's project that I run, and she raised the kind of alarm. She said, we're fed up with poverty wages. We've been risking our lives throughout the pandemic. We're ready to organise. They organised in a matter of 2 or 3 months, Billy, less than that. And we went for voluntary recognition in a very short space of time. And we've been building, well, the workers have been building a strong, strong base. They're all very united. They've been working together for a long time. Some have been there decades, so there's a lot of trust and unity there already, and we've been following their lead. They've been organizing and they're the experts in this dispute.
Regarding the strike action, we had so far two picket line. The first picket line was from the 15th, 16th and 17th of January. The second one was from the 4th to the 8th of February, and our demand was 12 pounds per hour, NHS sick pay and annual leaves, a collective voice at work, better work condition, paid 1 hour of break for night shift, unsocial hour, and in one way, better stop the discrimination and bullying at work. We were just asking for respect, dignity, and equality. Regarding to the picket line, at Sage Nursing Home, most of our staff are all migrant workers. So for us, and where I am coming from and where most of my colleagues are coming from, dancing teach you some social pattern and most importantly, a value. So going to a picket line and dancing for us is a way to express our feeling, is a way to define ourselves, is a way to illuminate and shine through our problems, frustration, and bring it out with our physical gesture we're doing. So for us, for instance, dancing through Jerusalem was a way to show to the community, to the world, to everybody who can see us, something wrong here, something needs to be changed, living wage needs to be changed, we need something better. So if you go into the Song of Jerusalem, for instance, if we tell you that Jerusalem, this is my way, try to save me, don't leave me alone, without a home, without a kingdom. So we want someone to come to save us. Who's going to save us? The board, the management, the government, society. We're going to look after us, a better living wage, a better sick pay, a better annual leave. So in this instance, we went for picket line with joy as a collective and we dance. People react in a very positive way because, as I said, dancing comes from all culture. So seeing somebody without music, we went to one picket line with no music. What we were just doing, dancing, making movement, being happy. So people reacted in a very positive way, blowing their horn, their honk. People were stopping, dancing with us, joining us, asking questions. People were seeing us because just of the way we were acting, and what we were doing, people kind of enjoy it and enjoy nice on a picket line.
Every UVW protest that I've been to, we've had music from all over the world, and it reflects our membership. You know, we're migrant workers union. So on the picket line in front of Sage, we had music from Latin America. We had salsa, we had merengue, we had Afro beats, we had disco, we had rock. It was contagious. That joy is contagious. That getting together, dancing, it's a form of you're expressing yourself, right? So that protest is contagious, and every single picket line that I've been on with the UVW, we've had massive speakers. And Billy's heard me say this before, I think when migrant workers get together, we bring the movement, you know, we bring some flavor, and it's a moment of power. It's the most powerful thing you can do, you know, being together, dancing together, showing your power in a very physical way is contagious. Performance and dance has got a long history, right? There's protests from all over the world. People protest all over the world dancing. And I'm from Chile, and we saw in 2019, the Feminist Collective La Tesis doing their dance performance dance. It's a way of getting your message out to a broader audience. And I think that's what we were doing on the picket line in Golders Green. People were stopping and they were saying, why are you dancing to Bob Marley, Stand Up For Your Rights? Why are you doing this? And we were then able to give them leaflets. We could show them our banners. It's about getting a message out to a broader audience as well as the kind of collective joy that you feel in protesting. Go on, Billy, I'll let you have the last words.
Yeah, to add to it, as I said, our demand was that we deserve better pay, we deserve better quality pay for what we're doing, because we looking after the elderly with dedication and compassion. So we think that we've been underpaid, undervalued, and overlooked for many, many years. So we think that enough is enough, and then that we need the support of everybody, the support of the care worker, the cleaner, the domestic. And then we need to all come together in the light of what we've done through our picket line. And as far as we are concerned, dancing for us is part of all culture. So we went outside there to express something, to celebrate, and then to shine, for people to see us and hear us through our union. So this is the way we do it, and this is the way we're still doing it. So for everyone else, we're also asking for donation. We're asking for recognition of our union. We're asking a better pay, a better living wage. We're asking for better sick pay. In one word, is a better living wage for all of us. And then if we have to do it, we do it. If we have to dance again, we dance again. Thank you.
Thanks to Billy and Isabel from the United Voices of the World. If you want to find out how you can help support the workers, who'll be back out on the picket line soon, head to the UVW campaign site, where you can donate to the strike fund for the next round of strike action and send protest letters to management and your MP. Dancing is a form of anti-racist, anti-fascist and anti-capitalist protest has a long history, and writer, activist and dancer Dana Mills has just published a book, Dance and Activism, about just that. We spoke to her about her book and the various international case studies she writes about.
My book, Dance and Activism, which is out February 25th with Bloomsbury, is really a study of what it means to be an activist dancer, what it means to use your body in order to change the world and to make it a better place. It's a global study. It goes to South Africa, it goes to Syria, it looks at Iraq, all sorts of other places in the world. The book encompasses a whole century. It starts in 1920 and it ends in 2020. And one reason I chose these dates is that around the 1920s, especially in New York, there was a really big politicization of especially the working classes on the Lower East Side. Most of them were immigrants. A lot of them were Jews. A lot of them were African Americans, people who lived in very poor conditions. But these were actually the people who created modern dance as we know it today. These were people who worked hard in factories and sweatshops and in the evening went and practiced and basically created a new form of dance that today is considered dance for stage. And one place I started from and one case study that guided me throughout the book is a work by American choreographer Martha Graham, who's considered widely the mother of American modern dance. Graham is a really interesting personality. She herself is one of a long line of descendants of the Mayflower. She came from, you know, a nice middle-class American family. And she relocated from California to New York, and that's where she really achieved her great fame. And she really, really revolutionized dance. But what's really interesting about Graham, and very much resonates with discussions we're having today, is that her dancers were hugely diverse, a lot of Jews. Some of the first African Americans to work on stage came through her company. Her company was always very diverse. And she really worked with people who had dual lives. A lot of them worked in factories and had a life as a worker, and then they went and rehearsed with her as dancers. And out of this really interesting trajectory, which of course happens in the shadow of the rising of fascism, she created a work called Chronicle, which is basically an anti-fascist dance work, which features women only. In the first few years of her work, Graham only worked with women dancers. And it's a really strong demonstration of anti-war, anti-fascism sentiment. So Chronicle for many years hadn't been performed. It was very much a dance of the times. It was premiered around the mid-late 30s. But then in the 1990s, there was an interest to reconstruct it and to work from old videos and photographs and some of the older dancers who were still alive. And during the years of both the rise of the right in the US, and especially after the Trump election, Chronicle returned and became kind of a key piece for the Graham Company. And it became especially really interesting for women and really important for women in the company who saw it really as a place for empowerment and for reenacting their power, and together with the women's marches and the Me Too movement and a lot of other political developments, Chronicle really resonated a spirit of a time. So you have this really interesting arc that starts in the 1920s, 30s and ends a century later with a dance that is basically shows that it's both of its time and outside its time. Now, in terms of the ideas around the book, I was really interested in two concepts and how they work in dialectic. One is alienation and the other one is solidarity. People like to discuss alienation far and wide, but for me it was a very visceral concept. It was the way that people felt disengaged from each other, from their political life. They felt disempowered from acting in the world. And to counter that, I thought about solidarity. And again, for me, solidarity is not just, you know, how you sign emails, perhaps, or how you talk in party meetings, but it's the feeling that you might have if you are with a lot of people who share your ideas on the street, or, you know, in our times could be in a Zoom, or in any place where you feel that you are not alone in the way that you think and feel. And I try to counter these two concepts and to see how they interplay in various dance forms, in various dance iterations, in various moments in time. One of the other case studies I looked at was during apartheid South Africa, a ballet company. We tend to think of ballet as a conservative and maybe elitist art form, but a very interesting woman who basically took young children, mostly under the age of 12, from diverse backgrounds at the time that it was actually illegal to let people be together from different races. This is under the apartheid regime, and created a multiracial ballet company. And, you know, I interviewed some people who came out of this company, and they said this was the first time that we saw an African, that we danced with an African. This was the first time that we had an encounter with someone who did not look like ourselves. But as I say, for me, dance is not just dance performed on stage. It's also dance that happens in all sorts of other places. So one of my so-called case studies is a very interesting young dancer called Hussein Semkom, who is a Kurdish Iraqi, who he was around during the Second Iraq War. That, of course, was very controversial here in the UK and in the US also. But for him, that was his life's existence, right? Like one day soldiers appear and that becomes your life's norm. But something that's really interesting that happened with him is that an American dancer took him aside and showed him videos of breakdancing on his iPhone. And Hussein became completely engrossed and completely entrenched in that and went home and started looking online at videos and basically taught himself how to breakdance from the internet. He got some more formal training through breakdance academies in Erbil and in other locations in Kurdistan. And in the end, he ended up going to New York, which is where he's now living and dancing. And it's kind of strange because he's now dancing breakdance where it actually originated from. Obviously, breakdance is a very quintessential African-American activist dance form. But this young man from Erbil felt it completely resonates with him. It completely expresses what he wants to say to the world. So this is another small example of someone who felt that dance is transformative for him and is a way that he can express something to the world beyond just speaking or acting as an activist. One thing that I noticed that is that people are using more and more their bodies in order to articulate a political message. So when people go to the streets together in times of great crisis and isolation, they try to move together. They try to mobilize their bodies together. So for me, dancer activists are not just dancers that take to the stage, but actually all of us, when we go and march and someone bangs a drum and then everyone starts to dance. That is, for anyone who's ever been on a protest, you know that it's a really special moment. It's an exhilarating moment. And I wanted to ask what that does to our conception of both politics and activism. There's a really interesting moment in which there's feminist uprisings around the world. Both Argentina and Poland have very repressive regimes that have tried and consistently are trying to legislate. And yet there's huge outcry and there's massive, massive demonstrations. In Poland, you know, I found a lot of evidence of people dancing through the protests, etc. In Argentina, actually, one really beautiful thing I found is the use of tango, you know, the world famous Argentinian art form that was mobilized as a feminist instrument. So first it started with women dancing tango with women. It's usually a very sexualized dance and it's a very, you know, male dominated dance in originally in its most traditional form. So now feminist tango makers are rejuvenating it, and you know, there's a lot of women dancing with women and women asserting their femininity through tango. But then I found really interesting articulations of pro reproductive rights through tango, which I thought was fascinating, and I had no idea when I set out to do the book. People tend to dance for diverse reasons, but they also find something that is quite shared in that, which is a way to express themselves that doesn't require language. Now, the one other really interesting and important element of dance as an extraverbal form of communication is that it can be international in a way that doesn't require translation. So we all know the kind of haphazard attempts to create dialogue between cultures where you have to sit and someone translates and there's like awkward silences. But if you create conversations or dissent or any kind of form of engagement through movement, you don't need to translate because dance really is an international language. And it's really interesting how some of the works that I discussed in the book, you know, when received in very different contexts to where they were created, still really resonated and still really influenced people who watched them, despite having very different cultural backgrounds. Now, I'm not a universalist. I don't think that, you know, we're all the same and we all react to cultural artifacts in the same way. But there is something about watching movement that doesn't require you to respond in words that can create a kind of dialogue that, again, is not necessarily holding hands and reconciliation. A lot of the works I wrote about are very angry works about dissent, people who feel deeply disenfranchised, but they can communicate that in a way that doesn't require them to translate and say, this is how we feel. So I think that's one really forceful element of dance that has always fascinated me, both as a dancer and as a dance writer. There is a very profound joy in dance that you could experience, again, it doesn't matter if you dance on the streets or if you dance in a club or if you go to dance class and whatever style you like. There is a moment of euphoria that is a very embodied feeling. And the fact that you can't put it in a box and you can't save it for later is actually some of its charm. And it's something that is very special. It's not like having a good writing sessions or even music that can be recorded in different ways. There is a dance notation system. There are several, actually, but there's a very famous one invented by Rudolf Laban. But they never really capture what it's like to either dance or be in a performance. And I think that we are now living in a time in which we're obsessed with capturing everything. I mean, everyone has 10,000 selfies and pictures of their windows and everything that they buy. And, you know, maybe there's something that needs to not be captured and that we can just retain within our bodies and not be able to transmit verbatim.
Are you guys going to stop ever? Or are you going to keep dancing forever?
I'm keep dancing forever, Ming. Well, at least till I remember where I put my car.
TWT is an annual festival and year-round political education project committed to providing political education across the UK in order to build a movement capable of radically transforming society. TWT relies on you. So head over to theworldtransformed.org to become a supporter.
After a long winter of lockdown abiding near hibernation, summer is finally on the horizon. And if the government's roadmap to opening up post-COVID holds true, in the coming months we will hopefully be able to party outdoors once again. One big outdoor party is Carnival. The tradition of Carnival, parades, costumes, music and dancing in the streets, is an important cultural formation across the world, including here in the UK. Next, we spoke to Labour activist Amira Cole about the important role St Paul's Carnival plays for Bristol's African Caribbean community, but also about the difficulties of maintaining autonomy against a backdrop of gentrification in the city.
So it started in 68, where it was called St. Paul's Festival. And that was local people getting together to really try and harmonise as communities, because there was lots of different people living in St. Paul's at the time. Although people think it was only Black people who were in St. Paul's, there were Irish people, there were Asian people, there were Chinese people all living in St. Paul's at the time. And it was a way to kind of get all those groups of people together to kind of have appreciations for each other's cultures and to just harmonise us as a community. In the 90s, it changed to, and that was under the chair, which was a Trinidadian chair, and that changed to St. Paul's African Caribbean Carnival, and that then gave a focus on African Caribbean culture, and therefore it saw the festival developing in a different region. It then had themes. It then had mass camps. Processions were part of this new carnival that was happening. And to also have a role within the African Caribbean community, the economics of that as well. So putting on the major event would mean that, you know, local people could have their stores. They could get involved in the costume making. They can be part of something that would bring you together as a community and take ownership of that. And also have a role in terms of providing some kind of training for local people as well. So there was training which was available in terms of being a steward or security, or even just people who wanted to learn how to make the mask costumes. You know, they were able to come along and learn those skills there. So the effects is longer than just that one day, because even to make that one day happen, there were so many other things that had to happen. And there was always a cultural program, which was about 2 weeks long prior to the main carnival day, which again, local people would get involved in to just show an appreciation for a culture, really, which was not promoted very well, had a bad reputation. St. Paul's had a bad reputation at the time. It's still, you know, with a lot of violence, a lot of black people living in the area, a lot of violence, a lot of police brutality. And it was just a way of people galvanizing and getting together and saying, look, we can still have a good time. We can still do these things. Yes, these things are happening, but we can kind of do something to just show, you know, we're not like what they're showing on the stereotype. So, yeah, it was just very, very significant to the community. Dance. Very, very important to the African Caribbean community. You know, dance is a way of storytelling. It's a way of telling how you're feeling at the time. It's a way of also getting you out of yourself. And in terms of the carnival, the procession was very important. So we had schools who were involved. Each school would have X amount of children who, I think they could have 30 children altogether. And you would have maybe 30 children in costumes, and out of that 30, you may have 15 or 20 who were specific around a dance. And the dance would always be part of the theme. The procession would actually tell a story. So the different costumes would then tell a story from the beginning to the end, and the dance would then go with that too. In sort of 2015, the Arts Council and the Bristol City Council withdrew their funding. Now, there's been so many reasons given for that, you know, they say there was allegations of mismanagement and all that. None of that has ever been proved. And from my personal experience of being of being chair of Carnival, I think this was another attempt by the councils, by the funders, to try and put pressure to direct the way the organisation went. At this time, Bristol wanted a more of a Bristol Carnival instead of a St. Paul's Carnival. They wanted it to be widened out. You know, there was lots of things going on in Bristol. Bristol wanted to be one of the major cities, and Carnival was a major part of that, being one of the biggest carnivals outside of Notting Hill. So in order to do that, to be called Bristol Carnival instead of St. Paul's Carnival, you know, meant a lot in terms of how the organisation would have to change. And a lot of chairs kind of resisted that for a long time. But then what happened was they withdrew the funding. So they just ran from 2015, 16 and 17, they ran little local events at the Markham X Community Centre, which were just locally based. You know, they called it Back to the Roots, and it was just like a wonderful local event. There was no funding, which was fine because that's the way it started, but it was a way of people taking ownership of that. Unfortunately, what happened with that as well was that they did this whole consultation around St. Paul's African Caribbean Carnival, and then they developed an organisation called St. Paul's Carnival CIC, which they led people to believe was the next stage of St. Paul's African Caribbean Carnival, which is not correct because that organisation still exists today. And what they did was they decided to have it on the same day as what St. Paul's Carnival was, because it was always the first Saturday in July. And so they took on some of the features of that. They didn't take on so much a focus of the African Caribbean, but, you know, it's the carnival. So we can see where it starts to go towards the Bristol way. What I would like to see for St. Paul's African Caribbean Carnival, I would like to see the African Caribbean community come together, and actually, because it has such a history and such a rich history, and it's a well-established organisation, to actually galvanise and get that organisation up and running again with a you know, with a all year round focus, where, you know, there are so many of our young people who are not finishing school, who are ending up into the criminal justice system and all that, having a role within the community, which is, you know, part of what a good organisation should do. It should serve its people.
Thanks to Amira Cole for that interview.
Hi, I'm Ollie Cox, an organiser at The World Transformed. I'm here today to speak with three venues around the UK about the work that they do and the struggles they face on their journey toward forming utopian dance spaces. So, can you introduce yourself and tell us about the space your venue provides outside of the typical power structures that you see in dance venues?
I'm Sophie and I work at Partisan Collective, which is an arts and social space operating not-for-profit in Manchester, but actually now Salford, since we've moved in the pandemic.
Yeah, I'm Teagues. I don't officially work at Partisan, but I kind of have like a freelance kind of role.
So I guess, yeah, the best way to think about Partisan is that it's a venue for all sorts of things, dancing and listening to live music and theatre, and all the activity and all the revenue that's generated from our venue goes into creating subsidised space for social justice groups. The way that Partisan is structured is a membership structure and a collective structure.
We want to try and enable our membership to have the most power within the organisation. So it's a bit different to a lot of venues where you'd have a top-down structure. We're kind of looking at more horizontal ways of structuring a venue.
So yeah, we're just trying to perfect this non-linear power system in the hope that we can sort of act as well as a model in successful delineated organising.
So yeah, I'm Liam from Casimir, also known as the Invisible Wind Factory. We're based in Liverpool. We sort of started life 2007, 2008. What came together was a group of people in Liverpool, a load of not from Liverpool, but just rocked up in anticipation of 2008 Capital of Culture. Managed to get hold of a space, turned into a workshop, and then evolved into a venue space. One thing led to another. That club is now gone. What remains is a sort of garden outdoor complex with a visual arts gallery, a micro music space. And in 2016, we sort of jumped over to the north end of Liverpool in the sort of post-industrial area, what's now called the 10 Streets. And we have a complex called the Invisible Wind Factory. And we're always sort of tussling with how to do activism and how to be radical whilst running essentially a big mainstream venue now.
So I'm Rodri. I'm one of the collective members at the Cube Microplex in Bristol. So yeah, we're a entirely volunteer-run, non-hierarchical space. And we also own our building. So we're really glad to have, about 6 or 7 years ago, put together a public campaign. And with donations and a little bit of match funding from the Arts Council, we were able to actually purchase the building that we'd been inhabiting by that point for about 16 years. And also, it's got an asset lock on it. We've got a community land trust, so that's a certain business structure that allows for community ownership of some asset. And that asset lock means that it can never really be sold on for anything other than weirdo arts collective purposes. So that transfer, if ever we sell the building, will have to happen to another community organization or another arts organization. Addressing this creep in terms of town planning to actually squeeze venues out of the city centre in favour of more residential building. And it's been really interesting in Bristol, particularly that how that conflict has played out.
Can you tell us about some struggles your venues have faced and maybe a little bit about the vision you have for the future of your dance spaces?
Obviously, the changing face of cities, huge amounts of like development in the city centres, pretty much in all the major cities around the UK and definitely in Bristol, seeing like 50 new skyscrapers going up in the centre of town. And obviously those are all residential. A lot of the time they're converted office buildings or things that are rushed through. And that means that people start living much closer to music venues. So now suddenly there's property owners in those spaces who have a right to enjoy their property, but at the same time seem to also have a right to ignore the fabric of culture in that area. And certainly the developers also seem to be able to do that. So I think one of the major threats to venues around the country is planning law. And the way in which residential property development is going on. Really, in this country, I think the planning system is the is one of the front lines of kind of the elitist encroachment onto public space, in the sense that it's an unelected council of people who decide what happens in your city, in your town.
Town planning and development is just, it is the thing. It's the thing with venues. And the creep was intense, you know. So I think there was a figure of like a couple of years ago where over the previous 8 years, the UK lost 50% of its music venues. And it's just like, that is, it's so serious, so serious. And the trajectory was just going, you know, just in that way. And it's so palpable when you walk around every city in the UK. It's the same thing. Bristol is exactly the same situation as Liverpool and Manchester, and these sort of cheap build apartment blocks. And I've put in a few planning applications myself for our venue. So I understand the process, and it's so ripe for manipulation. Like, so developers just run rings around the bureaucracy. There's not enough planners. It's very robotic in its process. It's all about these acronyms and policies and this and that. You just throw enough consultants at it and you can build whatever you want. You know, you just build up, build cheap, and you'll make that back. So developers just, they do run the city, simple as that. Something really massive happened in planning policy where, you know, it was the idea of just freeing up the market and to let it go a bit wild. But it really has ripped away a lot of protections for us from developers. And there was like years of progress with so many sort of collaborative bodies and everything from the Music Venues Trust to Nighttime's Industry Association. And a lot of hard work went into it. I think it's lost some teeth, that.
Yeah, I think for Partisan, it struggled with the same issues that Roger was talking about in terms of gentrification and rent prices of spaces like our old home being like astronomical. But I think also one of the, you know, the biggest struggles, especially for places that organise in the way that Partisan does as a collective, the internal structure struggles and the struggle continuously of capacity for people who are organising and volunteering in their own time. Yeah, the push on capacity has always been a struggle to tackle issues within the organisation. But it's a bit of a double-edged sword, the pandemic. You know, the fact that we've been closed for nearly a year and we've moved and we haven't been doing physical things in our space with our community. But we have had lots of time to reflect and do lots of good work, or, you know, at least begin lots of good work to addressed issues within the way the structure of the organisation worked. One of the main things that I see in lots of kind of dance spaces and venues and festivals in the UK, so much of the management is by white people. And I think for a proper utopian vision of future dance spaces, there needs to be representation at every single level, not just having revelations about improving lineups for events, but representation from like management down to workers to volunteers. As soon as that changes and there is representation at every level, then these spaces will be for everyone.
A ritual in many ways is a statement of how we want the world to be, and we can do something about the microcosm, but we can't necessarily influence the macrocosm straight away. But we can together at least create this little world that represents the values and the things that we hold dear. So yeah, in that sense, dance spaces are little incubators for weirdness and collective joy. And, you know, the image that comes to mind, the very esoteric image that comes to mind, is the kind of astrological archetype of Cancer the crab, because you've got a very hard shell around a very gooey, soft center. And I think that in many ways also relates back to the cube. We do our absolute best to create this very strong shell around this space. We take our fire safety responsibility seriously. We do the legal requirements that are necessary. We make sure everybody's like feeling safe to cooperate, and then chaos can happen safely in the boundaries.
I think organizations like this pretty much are going to struggle with these kind of things all the time. Like, there's going to be constant internal struggles and ebbs and flows of power. I think the one thing to come back to is dance, like, and enjoyment of space. Like, that's the future for all of us. Like, that's the thing that gets us together and makes us happy. So can't wait to make that happen again. I've been dreaming about all the exciting events that I can that we together can put on.
Thanks to Liam from the Casimar, Sophie and Teagues from Partisan, and Rodri from The Cube for taking part in that discussion. Trying to create equitable, diverse and utopian community spaces through dance is not just a modern struggle. David Mancuso's loft parties, starting in New York City in the 1970s, sought to do just that. And it's to that example we now look, with academics, DJs and sound system operators Tim Lawrence and Jeremy Gilbert.
Bring your own bottle or whatever turns you on. You can bring your old lady or your other number one. I got all of the latest jams and a great big place to dance. We might disturb the neighbors, but I'll take that chance. Gonna have a house party.
Okay, so we're talking about The Loft, and The Loft is the name for what was originally really just a party at somebody's house in a loft in New York at a time in history when living in a loft apartment in New York didn't mean you were a millionaire. It was a cheap housing option for bohemians and artists. And The Loft was basically a regular house party thrown by this guy called David Mancuso, but it developed into a regular weekly gathering, and it effectively became the template for what came to be known as the disco movement or the disco scene. And as such, it really ended up forming the template for everything we recognize as modern and contemporary dance culture. You know, the idea of people dancing in a room together to an extended sequence of records with a particular kind of atmosphere, it pretty much all originates there. There's things before it, there's things after it. But if you're looking for a place where our contemporary idea of dance culture emerged, it's there at that moment. The person who's really responsible for excavating that history and for sort of demonstrating the extent to which The Loft has that sort of originary status is my friend Tim Lawrence, who's here with us. So what was it? What was that thing that happened?
This was a party that was taking place in someone's room. It wasn't taking place in public. So David wasn't bound by the New York City cabaret licensing laws, so didn't have to end the party at 3:30 in the morning. This meant that the party could run much later than places that were going on in public discotheques. And it allowed a kind of deeper and more intense dynamic to take shape between David and the dancers that kind of enabled this thing that we understand now. I'd say maybe not so much disco, but DJing to kind of emerge for the first time. Up until this point, DJs were mainly interested in manipulating their dancers and basically every five records, sending them to the bar in order to kind of go and get a drink. And they would do this by building a crescendo, then putting on a slow record. David wasn't interested in that. He wanted to have a transformational experience. And so he engaged in a conversation with his dancers. So it wasn't the DJ manipulating the dancers, but entering into a kind of democratic exchange.
That's why The Loft, you know, is important, because The Loft, we clap after we heard a song. They don't clap after they hear a song.
That's
in
right,
there, unless it's the last song. And what happens is that when you're in there and you're enjoying yourself and you go ahead and you're getting your groove off and everything else and you hear a fantastic record and the record ends, you hear an applause, you realize the DJ did his magic. He did That's his right. job. He made you feel happy and everybody else knew it.
People have been dancing throughout history, but David kind of entered into this situation wanting to create a kind of progressive situation, which was deliberately utopian. For example, there was no money to be exchanged on the dance floor. Once you paid your entrance donation, everything was free, including food, whatever you might want to drink, although there was no alcohol for sale. And the other thing that Love Saves the Day, of course, tapped into was the fact that acid at the time was the drug of choice. And people going to this party took acid, and it just meant that the orientation of the party was really quite different. It was about connectivity. It was about expansiveness. It was about love and the spreading of love. So all of these things came together and led to, you know, what we might even call one of the first DJ sets, if you like. David selecting music for a period of 6 or 8 hours in relationship to kind of the energy of the dancers. So it became a new form of democratic music making.
The project of The Loft was always a sort of utopian one, wasn't it? The idea was always to create a space in which a kind of an experience, a kind of ideal experience of collective enjoyment could be created. Wanna say a prayer for you? So who was going to the party?
It was a form of a kind of embodiment of the countercultural revolution. Certainly, anyone walking into that room from the outside would note that there were a lot of people of color, a lot of gay men. It was a diverse situation. in which anyone was welcome. When I was doing this, the book Love Saves Today, and I was interviewing David, trying to kind of nail down the identity of the crowd, and kept on asking David about, you know, the black gay contingent. David was always very insistent that it was this kind of, it wasn't a party that was organized according to identity. The idea was you come as you are. Nobody, David told me, nobody is checking your identity on the door. So it became a space where there were many people of color, there were queers, there were many women, all groups that were kind of, you know, central to the countercultural movement.
And that sense of that quality of the crowd, I mean, I would say really carried on for decades. I mean, the Loft went on, it became really successful. It became this regular weekly event. It became sort of the inspiration for the first wave of innovative nightclubs and parties in New York. I mean, even sort of very ethically different institutions like Studio 54 borrowed kind of techniques and elements from the Loft. But then what a lot of people don't know, especially people who just know a potted history of disco in the 70s, is the Loft didn't just stop at the end of that decade or something. In fact, it carried on in some form or another. It still carries on. And when I first went, I went to one of the Loft parties, the date was still alive, that he was DJing. It would have been, what, 12, 15 years ago now, something like that. And I remember just walking in thinking, well, seeing the crowd, it was just sort of astonishing. By this point, the Loft was like 40 years old, and there were literally people who'd grown up there. Like, because one of the features of the party was that David had always encouraged people to bring children kind of early on in the night. And so I walked in, and the way I always describe it to people is I say, well, the room, as far as I could see, there was about a third white, a third black, a third Hispanic. And there was no generational cohort was actually represented more than any other. There were people aged 8 and there were people aged 80, and there was every age in between. And I always say it was like walking into Sesame Street, and it was absolutely utopian. And it was also really striking for someone like me who'd grown up in the kind of 90s rave scene that, you know, British rave had this self-image as a sort of utopian multicultural space, but it had never been at all. You know, there were always very few kind of raves that were very thoroughly mixed in terms of the ethnic composition of the crowd, and none at all. I mean, there were isolated institutions like Wordy Gig, but there were no kind of, you know, raves and clubs that had this sort of mixture of ages. And it was like, it was the promise of the cosmopolitan crowd being really kind of realized and manifest. And it really does have that kind of utopian quality.
One of the early popular early records played at the Loft was Boris Gardner's Melting Pot. One of the things I've started to argue is that, you know, New York has this mythological reputation as being a kind of the melting pot city, thanks to its long history of immigration. But before 1970, I really don't know if there was anywhere you could go in New York where you could meet all of these different diverse groups of people in the same space at the same time. Apart from anything else, it was still illegal for two men to dance with each other until the end of 1971, and the Loft was opening in February 1970. The Loft kind of had this quite subtle influence on other parties, much more on the private party scene than on the public discotheque scene. I mean, it was the private parties, because of their intimacy, because they met not only in the same space every week, in the same space and time every week, but also had these invite systems that were often meant to be inclusive rather than inclusive. But these invite systems enable these communities to form. It contrasts quite radically with the transient nature of much of party culture today, for example. So David was really bringing people together with this kind of idea of this kind of melting pot of everyone being welcome.
I'm talking about every single person in this club will sit down in the circle one by one. Everybody did their thing, if yep. they knew how to dance or not. And then we all stood
and it was
there.
Beautiful,
and it was just one big happy family. Yeah. And afterwards, then we all integrated together in this one powwow in the circle. And it yep. was all the time yeah. ritual form.
But
we look forward to
I
that.
I have to say one thing.
He was very kind of emblematic, I thought, of a sort of new left politics. He was always about the rainbow coalition. It was never about segregating, fragmenting, dividing. And the more that capitalism kind of developed in the late 20th and early 21st century, and the more sort of fragmented and tailored and niche oriented the entertainment sector became, the more David kind of fell out of time, if you like, with what was going on within kind of the, you know, the wider wider culture and the wider economy. But I think if we want to hold on to a utopian idea of what partying can be like, it's to the loft that I and I think maybe you as well, we keep returning as the most progressive, most inclusive kind of model. And one indeed that has remarkably resisted kind of commodification, incorporation. So on the one hand, the loft is very much out of time in terms of how you're going to organize a party in today's world and the values that people are looking for. You know, you can't book the loft, go to the loft on Resident Advisor. This is could be deeply shocking for many people. It just doesn't operate that way. So on the one hand, David's out of time. On the other hand, he's the critique of the contemporary, you know, and it's a lasting embedded critique. It's a party that's endured for 50 years. And, you know, its foundations and its principles must be very, very, very strong in order to do that.
Tim and Jeremy are launching a new podcast named after this very tune, Love is the Message, looking in detail at the legacy of the loft, of the music and dance of counterculture, and of the social and political formations of party cultures from the late 60s to the present day. Basically, if you like what you just heard, you're going to love it. So search Love is the Message wherever you get your podcast and subscribe to be the first to hear when it drops. We've talked at length about the social and political importance of dance and why we as socialists should take it seriously. But we haven't touched so much on simply how good it feels. We want to close out this episode with something else from Jeremy Gilbert, an extract from his essay, I Would Believe Only in a God That Knows How to Dance, read by friend of the show Chloe Massey. Until we can all get together on a TWT dance floor again, we hope you're feeling inspired to imagine, demand, and build a world transformed.
I would believe only in a God that knows how to dance. Dance erases two boundaries at the same time. It suspends or erases the distinction between matter and spirit, an elevated mental state induced by corporeal practice. It breaks down the boundary between self and other, between individual and group. The dancing crowd is unified and differentiated at the same time. It is in motion, but in formation. It is one and many. The God who dances is an immanent force, a force of multiplicity and inherent creativity. David Mancuso once said that he often felt that all parties are just local expression of the one big party taking place everywhere, all the time, that occasionally we manage to tune into or express through our own bodies and gatherings. What David seemed to sum up in this single image was the fact that the joy of dancing in groups is an intense expression of the inherently creative capacity of the social relations that always constitute all of our being. What I call the infinite relationality of existence. The cosmic dance of matter. The multiplicity of the multitude. The creative power of complex groups. To acknowledge the God who dances is to acknowledge them all.